Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Linda Cracknell is the author of Doubling Back, 10 Paths Trodden in Memory, a moving memoir where she retraces 10 walks undertaken by others from the Highlands of Scotland to the Swiss Alps and Kenya. It's been chosen as Book of the Week on BBC Radio 4. In our interview, we explore how she sets out to write a narrative of a journey on foot, what she leaves out, and how she draws in the reader to the journey or the story she tells. Now living in Scotland, her surroundings offer her plenty of variety for walks, short or long, in the surrounding countryside, much of which is devoid of people since the Highland clearances. Nature and isolation are both important elements in her writing, as are memories conjured of or animated by other walks, some personal, some collective, some political. Linda's been influenced by the land artist movement, and especially by Richard Long and Hamish Fulton, but is also stirred by the romance of setting off, as captured in the writing of Robert Louis Stevenson and Laurie Lee. When you set out for the walks, some of them you planned and some of them you didn't. The Drove Road that left your front doorstep all the way to Skye. Did you set out with a notebook and take notes of what you witnessed or encountered? Or is it something that you write, you know, in reflection or from memory?
These particular walks that are in Doubling Back, I'd planned them in the sense of I kind of knew physically where I was going, but they weren't always planned in the sense of knowing what I would draw from them. And what I have discovered is that if I don't take notes, I don't observe as well. And so my little system that I've developed is that I make these tiny hand-stitched notebooks, just from pieces of folded paper and an old birthday card or something. And they're tiny and they'll fit in a pocket. And they've got a pencil attached on a piece of string. And I've just got that in my pocket so that I've got no excuse not to note something down when I observe it. And of course, there's this funny thing that happens with note-taking and memory where once you've written it down, you kind of almost don't need to refer to the note because it is somewhere in your brain. But I've realised that the walks I've done when I didn't know I was going to write about it and I didn't take notes were very much harder to write about afterwards because the quality of the observation wasn't as sharp in my memory. And then typically what I would do in the evening, I would then write that up in a kind of journal. And then the actual kind of writing of anything more in a kind of better form out of that would come along later. And one of the things about this project is that it's taken quite a long time. I wrote all the essays from all of the walks quite quickly afterwards. And I think in some ways that was perhaps an error because they've needed a lot of work to kind of hone them and give them a shape and structure, which has become easier and easier as they've gone further and further into the past because I can appreciate them more as a reader, I suppose, as the time's passed rather than... It's such a joy to write the journey again, because it's a way of reliving the journey, that I think I was probably enjoying that too much and forgetting that actually you need to be really selective to write about a walk because otherwise it's not going to be a very compelling narrative.
Yes, I mean, I imagine it's quite difficult if you walk 200 miles to restrict how much you write about.
Initially, that piece was a very long essay and I think I tried to put into all my ideas and you just can't do that, and so inevitably it's ended up being a kind of series of episodes with big chunks of what actually happened and missed out. Some of what I've written about in these essays isn't directly something in the walk. It might be triggered by something I've been thinking about as I've walked, which is associated in some way with the landscape, or a little bit of research that I've done about the history or whatever. I think that's why it's really taken a long time to find a way of putting the narrative together, which is going to be, yeah, just kind of more appealing to a reader rather than telling them every footstep of the way.
So if we can go back to the mountain with the unpronounceable name.
Shehalion, yes.
Just tell us, what is the history to this extraordinary dry stone dike that runs for 2 miles up a mountain?
It kind of dates back to when the land enclosures were still happening, which from memory is mid-18th century, I think. Basically, it was a boundary between two estates and would have divided their land. I did actually walk it with a dry stone diker, which was really interesting because he could look at it and say, you know, well, this is roughly how much they would have done in a day. And they would have had various people around them who were bringing them piles of rock from little quarries all the way up the side. So, well, one thing that I loved about it was that the wall itself was like the kind of earth turned inside out. All along its course, you would see what was underground nearby. So the rock changed in nature slightly as you went further up the hill. It petered out just, you know, sort of right high up where the mountain became steep enough that animals would have been discouraged from going around the top of it. You know, the current landowner couldn't tell me very much about when it was built, but that was certainly the reason for it. It was just, that's what people did at that period, is they put up boundaries between different chunks of land.
And I'm intrigued. Did you walk uphill and then back? I mean, it's that type of walk, is it? It is only a linear walk.
And that was what appealed to me, because it was so linear and so straight. When I was doing my undergraduate degree, which was at in Exeter, I was doing combined honours in English and fine art. And my dissertation, which was the thing that I probably enjoyed most out of the whole degree, I chose to do a kind of investigation of the chalk figures in the south of England, which I'm interested to see one of your other interviewers has done a project around, the White Horses, and to look at the contemporary land art movement and various things, and to kind of tease out some relationships between the two. And at that time, I discovered Richard Long, and I've kind of watched his work over that period ever since. And I'm really drawn to both the kind of expeditional nature of his work, sometimes these great journeys that he does, but also some of the visual things with a kind of line that cuts through a meadow, which is just worn by walking, that kind of thing. I do really respond in some way that I can't completely explain to lines in the land, and that was one of the walks that did that. Although that one, as I said, because it kind of turned into a fiction piece, that hasn't ended up being in Doubling Back, but I've published it in a little book on its own. I've got a series of small books called Best Foot Books, which have captured some of the ones that escaped.
If you'd like to explain how it became a fiction piece rather than an essay.
The form that I was intending to write for all the walks that I did was non-fiction, because I am really, I mean, I see myself principally as a fiction writer, but I wanted to take a diversion into non-fiction to kind of use walking as the subject matter, rather than I see walking as kind of part of my set of tools for fiction writing, but I wanted to make it actually the subject matter of some writing. When I set off, I went and did this, walked along this wall several times, up and down, and I started making notes. And in the course of making the notes, a voice just manifested itself in what I was writing down, and I eventually realised that it was the voice of the wall. I just followed it to see where it would go, and so what the piece turned into was a conversation between the wall and a walker, as the walker followed the length of the wall until it kind of crumbles into nothing at the top. As I say, I kind of thought of that as non-fiction, because actually it has kind of elements of information in it about the nature of the wall and the building process and so on. But apparently talking walls belong in fiction, not non-fiction, so it's not in Doubling Back for that reason.
The stories that you've written about following our fathers, you were telling me earlier about how you walked with some people from Norway whose father had been involved in the resistance in the war, and how he'd walked as a route to escape. When you've approached writing about other people's walks, how do you choose the walks you're going, you know, the walks that people have undertaken? Is it the walk that draws you to it, or is it the endeavour, or the individual who's walked the walk?
It's both. The one that came to mind immediately from the walk in Norway was actually following my own father, who died when I was really young. I was only 18 months old, and I have no memory of him. And I realised that when I was on the walk in Norway, I thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to do a walk like this for my own father, who was actually, he was very young when he died. It was in his 30s, but he was a very keen mountaineer, and that was one of the things that I didn't know about him. I realised that I just didn't know that much about where he'd been as a mountaineer, and on researching it a little bit, the main mountain that people could remember in my immediate family that he'd climbed is a big mountain in the Swiss Alps called Finsteraarhorn, which is about 4,200 metres high. It's a biggie. I thought, wouldn't it be great to do a walk to memorialise him? And that didn't have this kind of compelling storyline of the Norway walk and somebody escaping and all the kind of danger inherent in that. But I felt that there was something I could do just to kind of honour my own father and his memory by following in his footsteps. And so that was quite an important one to me. By a series of coincidences, I was able to do that walk. I thought it would be too much for me to try. I'd never climbed in the Alps, and it's quite an undertaking. And I'm not keen on going on commercial expeditions. I like to plan things myself. And I thought that was going to be my only option, but I was very fortunate in having two friends who had decided to go and do a climb in the Alps to mark their 50th birthdays, and the mountain that they had chosen was Finsteraarhorn, and so they very nobly took me along with them. So that was chosen because it was my father, and that was the walk. That took me into completely new terrain. But another example would be kind of almost following myself. When I was 16, 17, I went to Boscastle in Cornwall on a painting holiday on my own. It was the first time I'd kind of... It was when we gave up having family holidays, I think, and it was my first time away from home. And I was working on an art portfolio for A-level. What happened on that week was that during the mornings I was painting at the studio, but as has become my pattern, anywhere I go, I kind of have to walk to get to know the area, and I kind of tend to walk in all directions until I feel that I've cemented myself in the place. And so off I went every afternoon with my Ordnance Survey map and explored the area. And in doing that, I discovered that Thomas Hardy had a real connection with the place as a young man there, and had written a great deal, both fiction and poetry, because he'd come there as a young architect and met his first wife there. And there was kind of quite a sort of story behind that, which ended up in the fiction and the poetry. That period of discovery was quite significant for me as at the age I was, and I was curious to go back and do some of the same walks again and see if it still felt as kind of magical and meaningful as it had done when I was 17. And fortunately it did, which was a pleasant surprise really, and it allowed me to rediscover some of Thomas Hardy's work that I hadn't looked at for a long time, and to kind of reacquaint myself with the place. And there was something very kind of comfortable and sort of enchanting about that kind of going back 30 years later and seeing what was still there for me. So it was kind of rediscovering myself as that younger person, but also rediscovering my passion for Thomas Hardy and for that area when I was younger. So that one was more kind of deliberately to do with the place. Another one was, again, more to do with a person who's a Kenyan friend of mine who grew up in a village just north of Nairobi. I'd been talking to her about this project, and I spent a year living and working on the island of Zanzibar. I'm just off Tanzania many years ago. And I just loved the fact that there was such a pedestrian culture there. I mean, people use bicycles and buses and things as well, but on the whole, walking was the way you get somewhere. And the walking was on these sort of beautiful foot-worn paths between villages. Any act of walking there was very sociable, because you'd always meet people along the way who were going in the same direction as you or another direction as you than you. She invited me to go and walk with her in this village where she grew up, where there was a kind of network of paths that her family had used over the years, to the place where they collected the water, primary school where her mother used to teach, the church where they went every Sunday, and so on. Really, I went with no knowledge of this village, but really it was about discovering more about my friend and her family. When we got there, we decided to do the walk barefoot because, well, she'd been talking particularly about the difference of walking with bare feet than with shoes on and how you feel much, so much more connected to the land. And of course, most people there would choose to walk barefoot because it, particularly in this place in the rainy season, shoes are just completely impractical. They just become totally clogged with mud. And so we did this walk barefoot, which added an extra dimension to it, which was very interesting and quite illuminating for me and quite sore.
And you've spoken about when you were a teenager and things, and as a member of a family went out walking in the hills and the mountains, and that was part of the enthusiasm. I mean, these days, are you a strider? Do you stride out as a brisk walker, or are you someone who goes at a slower pace to try to absorb as much around you as possible?
I think I'm getting slower. If I have a day when I'm working from home, I will go out for a walk for at least an hour. That will be a bit of getting exercise and a bit of the kind of just the nice thing of using the walk as a bit of meditation and reflection and refreshing the body at the same time. That could be quite a kind of amble rather than a stride. If I'm setting out to do a longer journey, I probably am a little bit more conscious of time and how long the day is likely to, you know, how long that section of the journey is likely to need and so on. So I probably have a little bit more of a feeling of needing to press on. One of the things that I will do to try and counter that sometimes, and this is where the observation comes in that's needed for writing, I think, is to very deliberately slow myself down and to do something which will make me really use the senses. And this is something which I kind of tend to bring into my workshops and teaching as well, which is things like if you're in a very familiar place, you kind of need to defamiliarize it a bit in order to find a way of observing it afresh. So things like just shutting your eyes and using your hands to explore it and listening can be very refreshing because you actually have a very different experience. We're so reliant on sight that sometimes just removing that sense can really alert your other senses to a different kind of contact with the place. I've never actually walked with my eyes closed, but walking at night's very interesting and for very familiar places, it completely changes it. Things like changing your level, so if you get down on your hands and knees and experience a place, or changing the scale. There was one occasion when I gave a fellow walker a terrible fright because I was crouched down in the bushes watching a spider crawl over a series of kind of leaves and twigs, like almost like obstacles. And I tried to imagine, if I was the size of the spider, what that little bit of landscape would be like. It was quite formidable, actually, if you saw it like that. So things like that, which just kind of give you a slightly different way of looking and experiencing a landscape, can just freshen up your observation. So it's almost like just putting yourself through a little kind of sensory examination and activity.
I'm really intrigued about whether walking is the catalyst for your work. Do you say that, you know, 3 days a week I'm going to work from 7 a.m. till 2 p.m. and then go for a walk? Or is your day or your writing not quite so disciplined?
I don't make a living from writing. It doesn't seem to really earn much money. So I make my living by teaching and workshops and so on. So, for example, at the moment I'm writer in residence in a children's hospital in Edinburgh. I'm doing sort of workshops in primary schools and various places and teaching on courses for adults who are aspiring writers, that kind of thing. That's really how I make my living. So my working week is usually very fragmentary, and it can mean that I'm away from home quite a lot. So I'm writing in quite a part-time way and fitting it in around other things. If I have a dedicated day for writing, my ideal would be to start the day with a walk. Not necessarily a very long walk, but just to kind of air the mind and the body, and then come back and I'll feel much more settled after doing that, and I'll have got some ideas from going on the walk. And then I would write, but at some stage I would probably need to go and walk again or do some other kind of activity. And I think the walking has quite a lot of different functions in writing, actually, because I certainly use it quite deliberately as a way of getting to know a place that I'm writing about. I had a novel which came out last year called Call of the Undertow, which is set on the north coast of Caithness. I really did use walking there as a way of getting the story, because the place has a lot of stories existing, and by walking there, I felt I was kind of familiarising myself with the stories, but also the characters started to emerge out of it. And my main character was a cartographer who has this kind of compulsion to walk as well, and so she ends up going through a similar process to I went through, getting to know the place by walking it. The other thing that walking does is it allows me to have this slightly unfocused way of thinking. So I can be observing a bit of what's around me. I can be observing a bit of what's going on in my head. And somewhere between the two, if I've got a problem in my writing, something which hasn't been coming, if I've been working already that day on it, usually the solution will come when I go for a walk. I think my ideal day would be to go out for a walk, settle down, do some writing. A number of problems will probably emerge. Go for another walk, during which ideally, as long as I don't look at them too closely, that some of the solutions will appear, and then go back and do some revision. To be honest, I don't have many days when I'm just sitting writing. It's usually a few hours here and there.
You've not just written a novel and a collection of essays, but you've also written for radio. You've written both drama and you've abridged works. Could you tell us a little bit about whether there's a connection there between radio and walking?
I think the connection probably between radio work and walking, it certainly for my own original dramas, is probably the same as for the fiction, that it's given me places. My radio plays tend to be very inspired by particular places. The latest one was set in Scotland's first public lending library, which is just about 25 miles from where I live, and it's now a kind of museum. It has quite an intriguing history to it. The idea for the play came up through a familiarity with the place. The play before that was set in the West Highlands, and that did come about through walking, really between various places near Lough Sunat. Again, it was a bit of a mixture of kind of research and walking, because I discovered when I was actually researching something else entirely that during the 1840s, there was actually a floating church on Lough Sunat. And the reason for that was because there was a big, what they call the disruption in the Church of Scotland in the 1840s, when the mass of the congregation abandoned the church and they had to find other places to worship. And sometimes they worshipped, as they did in this particular community, between the high tide and the low tide mark, because the landowner couldn't own that. That was kind of God's land. But this particular community, their ultimate solution was they commissioned the building of a floating church. I'd walked in between. There's a sort of an old road which connects the Lough side with a mining area up on the hill there, and I'd walked to and fro on that. Again, a lot of things became evident from that. Like, there was a well along the route, a spring rather, that was dedicated to St. Fillan, and it had been a coffin route where they carried the coffin over to Finnan's Island and things like that, which suggested quite a lot of the content for the play and had a sort of slightly mysterious supernatural quality to it. So I think that's probably the influence of walking on my radio work is quite similar to the influence on my fiction writing. I am a big fan of Robert McFarlane's work, and I loved his Mountains of the Mind, his first book. When the opportunity came along to abridge The Wild Places, that was something that I really enjoyed doing. But abridgement, yeah, I mean, it gave me a way of knowing that book very well, which was really nice. I would say I would count people like Robert McFarlane and Rajesh Chahada, who has written about walking in Palestine and the increasing restrictions on his home territory over the period that he's been walking there. They're quite important influences, as were some of the older writers, like the romance of setting off, which I find very much in Robert Louis Stevenson and Laurie Lee and writers of that nature. And then more on the kind of nature-y side, I suppose. Kathleen Jamie, obviously, love her essays and her poetry, actually, but I particularly love her essays. But they're probably kind of some of my main influences. Okay. But I think the land artists, Richard Long and Hamish Fulton, people like that, were early, very early ones.
Have you got a couple of walks you could recommend?
Well, what I'd like to recommend is actually not specific places to walk in, but specific kind of ways of walking. One of them would be to do a walk that's very familiar to you, one that you maybe you do really quite regularly, but to walk it in a different way so that you're kind of much more aware of all your senses working. So it's going to mean, you know, those things like closing your eyes or taking a blindfold with you or getting down on your hands and knees, walking backwards even, you know, that anything which makes you experience it in a slightly different way, and take a notebook. And the other one would be to think of, I do like the whole idea of pilgrimage in a very sort of loose sense, and I think that that can be about celebrating, you know, if you think about people who have been important in your lives or family members or whatever, if there's a way of celebrating someone through doing a walk that they loved or wanted to do maybe and never had the chance to do, that would be another recommendation.
You talk about memory and trying to record or interpret memories created in the landscape, and this is something that is less of the determined walk to conquer a summit or to explore a particular place in terms of discovering it geographically, if that's the right way of putting it. It's more nuanced than that. Do you want to try and sort of tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I think I probably did a lot of walking which had no real purpose apart from walking, you know, from point to point, which that actually does have a lovely sense of purpose when you're doing it. But after the walk in Norway, I did become a lot more focused on following something. And I guess the lines that I've been interested in physically in the land, I was also interested in lines which are a bit less tangible, but the kind of ghostly traces of echoes of memories or people who'd trodden the ways before, like drovers or pilgrims or whoever. And I think by necessity, that kind of takes you out of the kind of drive to be, I guess I'd had a bit of a thing about being in a, what we might think of as a kind of wilderness area, and walking through it because of that. But actually, I became a lot more interested in places that have sort of still have these faint echoes. And that usually means being a bit lower down, not being so interested in ticking off summits.
More in the civilised area than the wilderness.
Well, so, some of it can be in what we now think of as wilderness, because particularly if you think about Scotland, because there's been so much, you know, that the land in general in the Highlands is so much more lonely than it would have been even 150 years ago. But there still are places where you have a sense that a lot of traffic has passed before, but now it's just, you know, it could just be you. Those places are very interesting to me, where you have that feeling just of kind of a lot of feet having gone that way for various reasons, but it now being very lonely. And it's quite sad in some ways. So it may be in what we think of as wilderness areas, but it's wilderness because it's been depopulated. You know, the places that I'm interested in, I love being in big natural landscapes, but it's the human, what remains of kind of human life in them that I'm particularly interested in, and that's maybe only evident in a path, or maybe in buildings or whatever along the way, or even just a kind of feeling that that's a kind of, has been an important through route in sometime in the past.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Linda Cracknell. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of EC Tronic.